Welcome back, everybody. Oh my goodness, it's been a while. I'm so glad to be doing this again. This is exciting. Welcome back to another edition of the Brew University Virtual Roundtable, Brew U Book Club Edition. I'm your host, Jeff Weaver, and I am super excited to be back with you and a group of bookies who are here with me so that we can break down our summer reading series. That's right. We're doing a short book club series this summer, all books that you can read at a day on the beach or lounging by the pool or maybe on that flight to Europe that everybody seems to be taking on Instagram that I don't know how you're all affording, but good on you. But wherever your summer vacation plans are taking you, these are all books that you can take along for the ride and come back with more than just a sunburn and a hangover, but a little bit of knowledge and motivation as well. So I have assembled my intrepid book club panel to talk about our book today. And first up on that panel, the queen bee herself, the OG of book club podcasting, Suzanne Borjar, HR director in Tampa. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, bookies.
Glad to have you with us. Also joining us for this round of the book club, a frequent guest on the Roundtable podcast, our president, Zach Kavanaugh, is here. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for hosting.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for being here. Another returning member of the Roundtable podcast and new to the book club as well, our communications manager, Allie White, is here. Hi, Allie.
Hi, everybody.
And up past his bedtime just for us because he's a real one like that. Nate Eisenhower, our warehouse manager in Tampa, is here as well. Hi, Nate. How's it going?
Doing great. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you with us. So the summer series, as I said, it's a series of books. Every one of these books is under 150 pages. They're all meant to be read in just one afternoon while you're lounging out over the summer. The one we're discussing here today is Tribes by Seth Godin. And this is a book that I have loved for a long time. I haven't read it in a long time. It's probably been about 10 years since I had revisited this book. But it's a great little book. So let me tell you a little bit about it and then invite my guests here to tell you a little bit about their experience with it. Tribes is sort of a pivot point in Seth Godin's career. If you're a marketing guru, you may remember Seth Godin's name. He's big in the marketing world, but this book sort of marked the transition for him into his pivot towards a more general leadership focus. And Tribes is really his thoughts and approach on how people can lead groups, naturally occurring groups of people with like-minded ideas and who want to be connected to each other. In fact, Seth defines a tribe as a group of people connected to each other and to a leader and to an idea, and that connection is what underlines it. So I'm really excited to have shared this book with you guys, and I'd like to throw it open and just ask for some first impressions. Did you know about this book? Have you heard about this book? Had you read it before? Was it totally new to you? What did you think? What did you expect? Give me some initial thoughts here, panel, and what did you think about Tribes in a big way?
Jeff, I'm happy to kick it off. This was my first time with any exposure to Seth Godin. I'm sort of embarrassed to say now that I've done a little research on Seth Godin and who he is and what he has done, but it was my first exposure to him. The way the book is structured, I think, took me a little bit by surprise. It's 150 pages long, and it's probably 140 little snippets or thoughts backed up by some sort of anecdote. So I found it really easy to breeze through. There's a lot in it. And I think at the end of the book, he comments that like, this is not a guide and you're going to find it very difficult to use as a guide. He just dumps a lot of information on you and sort of asks you to sift through it and pick out what you think is useful and valuable and actionable for you. I found myself within the first couple pages doing more jotting down a long list of questions of, you know, do we do things this way, that way, the right way, the wrong way? How can we do things differently? Rather than jotting down what I typically do when I read a management book is jot down ideas and things that I think I can take away and use to improve myself or my team. I didn't get a lot of those. I got about 50 questions. So if at some point it opens up for questions, I've got plenty of questions to throw at other people, but very few answers.
I love a book that generates as many questions as it does answers, which is why I've always enjoyed Seth's stuff. He's excellent at doing exactly that, provoking thought and not necessarily giving you the answer, but leading you in a direction for sure.
When I was reading it last night, I just kind of find myself comparing what we went through when I took over the night shift and different scenarios, and that's a lot of what happened because we had a group of people that didn't want to be here, really. So we they slowly got rid of themselves, and now we have a tribe of people that will kind of do, you don't have to sit around and micromanage them, kind of manage themselves. You got your individual little tribes, as we'll say. And I just found a lot of comparison through what we've went through over the last couple of years with my department.
That's interesting, Nate, because when I read it, I thought of the night warehouse in Tampa too, and you taking over and sort of leading that team and bringing them together. Many of the things he spoke about and just what you did to engage the team to bring leaders themselves really spoke to me in what he was saying. And I know we'll get into some of those pieces too, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to dogpile on the Nate appreciation bandwagon and say I'm also very glad that you were able to join us on this one, Nate, for exactly that reason. I think what has happened in that Tampa warehouse under your leadership is a really shining example of tribes at work. There's a culture there. There's a community there. The difference between then and now is that you can tell people want to be a part of that group. And we'll talk certainly more in depth about it, but I'm glad to have your insights on this, because I think that's certainly true, both from an inside and outside perspective, that our Tampa warehouse right now is a great example of a tribe in action. So that's why I'm glad you were able to get in on this one. Allie, any thoughts to kick us off with?
I loved it. I think the format took some getting used to, and it was a lot of highlighting and jotting notes down and picking pieces from each little bit that relate to my life. So, but I liked it overall, and he's funny.
He is, and he's a very clever writer. And I think one of the things I've always appreciated about Seth's books in general is there's a real momentum to his books, because you're constantly waiting for him to get to the answer. He's posing these questions. He's energizing you. He's gearing you up towards this idea. And you keep going because you're like, okay, when am I going to turn the page and find the solution to all these problems he's making me recognize? And they never come. And it propels you through the book, which is great. But it also simultaneously can be certainly frustrating as a leader who's looking for solutions, because I think a lot of what he gives us is questions and thoughts and provocation. Another thing I wanted to mention off at the top is this book was written in 2008. I'm not sure if you guys knew that or picked up on that, but this book was written 15 years ago, and the world this book was written in is a very different world from the one that exists right now. It feels like a book that could have been written last week about the next 10 years, but at the time that this book was written, there's a couple things that I think are worth noting. So 2008, the iPhone was 1 year old and had sold 4 million units. The comparison is today they sell 1 million a day. So at that point, there were 4 million iPhones in the world. Today, 1 million a day go out the door. Instagram, Snapchat, and TikTok did not exist when this book was written. And for as much as he talks about social media and social networks in this book, it's amazing to realize that three of the biggest that we would consider the basis for many tribes in our current culture were not even on the map. Instagram wouldn't come along for two more years after this. It's kind of incredible. And this one just amused me to no end. But this was so far back in the timeline that Twitter still called posting twits instead of tweets, which he actually makes reference to in the book. There's a point where he's like, people are posting their twits. And it took me a second to go, oh, that's right. They originally tried to get twit to be the phrase, and then tweet took itself over. In fact, it's sort of a great example of a tribe at work. Twitter itself decided that tweets were tweets and not twits, and another fun little bit. So it's a fascinating book to be as prophetic as it is. But what I think is interesting here is Godin, you know, what works about this book is he's describing a vision reached by understanding human nature, i.e. tribalism, and looking at where technology was taking us. And I think that's the first point he makes that I want to sort of kick off from, is that, you know, fundamentally, tribes aren't a new thing. Tribes have been around since the dawn of time. He doesn't get into a lot of the evolutionary imperative of tribes being sort of hardwired into us, but he does acknowledge that the tribes have existed long before the internet and the web and all these things, and they're going to exist forever. But communication, which is at the heart of the tribe, is enabled by the technology. And it's the technology that makes tribes more accessible, more prolific than they've ever been. He really almost speaks of them as being inevitable. They're going to happen. They are happening. They'll continue to happen. And so his argument at the beginning is that someone has to lead these tribes. These tribes are going to happen. they need leaders in order to really coalesce and make progress, and that that responsibility is up for grabs, regardless of your title, your stature, your position. It doesn't matter. It's the tribes are there. They want to come together. They want to do things. It's up to us to sort of grab hold and take. So what did you guys think about sort of his general thesis about tribes in general, which is they're there. Somebody's got to lead them.
I think my original thought, you know, in listening to it, thinking about the tribes that I'm part of and, you know, personally, Peloton, workout, yoga studios seem to be communities of people that get weird together, you know? So then I was trying to think about at work, and that's sort of where Nate's group popped up, of course, our crushers popped up. But then, of course, like Zach got me thinking, like, where else could we invigorate the tribe's community thought from a work standpoint?
I think the thing that most impressed me about his general thesis is directly related to the timing that you were just talking about. So if his general thesis is everyone's expected to lead, change is easier than it's ever been, change and creation are now rewarded and they can be fun and profitable, saying all of that before the advent of a social media influencer who can now do, you know, 10 seconds videos of whatever they happen to be doing in their daily life, gardening or fixing cars or whatever, who are making thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, having fun and essentially just leading a group of people with similar interests, I thought was pretty profound.
Yeah, his thesis really predicts the rise almost of influencer culture, right? It's what is a tribe? You know, he says a tribe is a group of people connected to each other and to their leader and to an idea. And that's every influencer that's out there. They pick their idea, whether it's fitness or fashion or relationships, whatever it is, they've got this idea. They're connected with their audience. Their audience can connect with each other. They can connect directly with the leader. And that's been enabled by social networking in a way that it never was before. And therefore, we're seeing more tribes than I think we've ever seen before. And to your point, Suzanne, it's true. We belong to so many of these, right? We've got our fitness tribe. We've got our Peloton tribe. We've got our work tribes. We've got our friend tribes. A tribe is, you know, it's a group of people with a common purpose and goal that can connect. But there's no shortage of them. And there's not going to be any shortage of them. And in fact, as the technology continues to make it more accessible, there's going to be more tribes than ever, which gives us as leaders an opportunity to say, well, what do I want a tribe? What's my tribe going to be? What tribe do I want to lead? What tribe do I want to exist? What tribe would I want to be a part of that isn't out there? And can I will it into existence that way?
It does give a different perspective just because as we're sitting here talking in different types of tribes, just being a fan of like certain sports teams and things like that. I mean, those are tribes that I'm a part of, or enjoying football. Like, we started a flag football team at work, so we have our own little tribe that we do there. Just different terminology gives you a different mindset on the way that you look at it, because if I use the flag football team as an example, the guys say, oh, we want to do this, but it takes someone to say, all right, well, I put the team together, I got this done, now let's show up and do it. And it's empowering them to now do something else that they want to do, but maybe they wouldn't have done on their own accord.
Nate, I love that example. I actually wanted to talk a little bit about this. It was in my notes to ask you about the flag football. So tell us a little bit, give us some context. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there, because not everybody's heard what you're doing, and I think it's a really cool thing that's come together.
So basically, we had some guys, we were doing some flag football stuff on the weekends just as a group, and they wanted to join a league. So in the past, I played in a league. So I suggested that we join the league again. So we did that. We put together a team. And so we've played 2 weeks now. It's not going so well. But we're having fun, and we're getting better. And it's creating a, you know, good camaraderie and something that we can all you know, relate to. And it's a different perspective other than work. So creates a different dynamic and gives us something to do that we all love to do.
How many guys from the warehouse have joined?
We got 13. So there's 14 people. We have one non-JJ employee that has played with us when we were out there that joined the team. So
well, it's always good to bring in a ringer. That's why I have you here.
Yeah.
No, I this is such an amazing example of tribes in action, right? I mean, here we've gone from a situation where, you know, our Tampa warehouse post transition into the pick pathing and order selecting that we're doing now, high turnover, a lot of discontent, a lot of people who were as happy to walk out the door as they thought they were to walk in, to now we're in a place where these guys want to get together on the weekend, on the one day off we give them from each other, they're choosing to spend their time together to go out and do something that has nothing to do with the work, but everything to do with being connected to each other. And if that's not the very definition of what a tribe can become, I don't know what is. I mean, that's the tribe at its highest functioning level. But to your point, Nate, it took exactly what you said. It took a group of guys who had a combined interest and then somebody to lead them and foster the communication and push it across the finish line. And, you know, hopefully we turn the record around there and we can all come out and watch you guys play the championship this fall.
Well, it's going to happen. You know, I'm on the team, so we're not going to lose for long. It's just going to take a little bit of coaching.
I do think that's a fantastic example. Other thoughts or examples or tribes that you think about in the context of JJ Taylor, you know, that sort of came across your mind as you were reading this section of what tribes are and how they come together?
The departmental, like, I mean, it kind of ends up breaking down by different departments. So, like, if we use operations as an example, say, different levels throughout the operation, you'll have different tribes. You might have your delivery that's together, you have your warehouse, and then it kind of sections off the deeper down you go into that rabbit hole. So I think that's, you know, some opportunity as well that we have to bridge those different tribes together to create more of a one team instead of you still have your departmentalized, you know, sections.
I thought about the same thing, Nate. I thought a lot about, you know, we have our teams, right? We've got our org chart. We've got our structure. There's sales, there's delivery, there's this and that. But then on a functional level, there are these tribes that exist almost geographically, right? There's the North Tampa tribe. There's the downtown tribe. There's the Sarasota tribe. We've seen how these little tribes come together, and it's the sales guys, the merchandisers, sales assistants, delivery folks, and the managers who cover a geographic territory end up becoming their own little tribe in a way over that territory. And yes, a manager might dip into this one and dip out of that one, and the configurations change, but that common geography, that common interest in a particular geography, coupled with a need to communicate and a little bit of guidance and leadership, can create really powerful tribes in those ways as well. And I think there's definitely some great examples in all of our locations of, you know, the Naples tribe, the North Charlotte tribes, these little tribes that come and coalesce around their geography, their territory, their shared set of accounts is definitely a way that I see tribes popping up around here.
It's really noticeable when we have all employee meetings. Because you'll have, like, after the meeting, you'll have different sections of kind of people who know each other more on a daily basis. Then you'll have certain people that'll intermingle and do all that stuff. But you definitely get a good, you know, picture when we have all employee meetings.
It made me think of, and I don't know if it would be a micro tribe or a temporary tribe, but it made me think of my GMP cohort. We were, you know, felt like such a tight tribe for that time that we were in class. And then even afterwards, everybody belongs to all these different tribes, but you still have that community bond where it's kind of a mixing of tribes. And
oh, for sure. And there's almost two levels to that, for sure, right? There's your individual tribe, the small tribe of the people you went to Great Manager with and graduated with. That's your little cohort tribe that you were a part of. And then there's the tribe of managers who have been and the managers who haven't yet, right? And we see this every year, the guys who are just champing at the bit to get into Great Manager because they haven't been yet and they don't feel fully part of the tribe. And that's by design. That is part of the structure and design, is that going to GMP is sort of that initiation into being part of our leadership team. It makes you part of the tribe. It's a rite of passage, and tribes can definitely have that element for sure.
So question, Jeff, and this may or may not make it to the final cut, but question is, GMP, Great Manager Program, Seth obviously feels very strongly about the difference between a manager and a leader. I don't think we call it the Great Manager Program any longer. I believe we call it the Ambassador Boot Camp. Is that right?
Yes.
Is there, is that part of the reason? Were we trying to drop the term manager to get people thinking more about leadership and leadership qualities as opposed to being a manager? Which, if you believe Seth's interpretation of management, it is largely dictatorial, top-down, task-oriented. You're going to do what I tell you to do, and that is going to be success if you successfully complete those tasks, versus leadership, which is a bit more abstract and far more about motivating people based on setting a achievable but ambitious goal and giving them the tools and the vision and the encouragement to go out and figure out how to do it themselves.
That's a great point, Zach. I actually had this up next in my notes as well, that Godin makes a very strong distinction between leaders and managers. He paints them almost as being opposites. Now, I think, you know, terms aside, I think what he's underlying there, the underlying message that you articulate, is exactly right. There's the defenders of the status quo, which he refers to as managers, and then there's leaders who are breaking the status quo, taking risks and going out, and therefore are able to rally and organize and lead tribes. We didn't drop the name exclusively to focus on that kind of language, but I think in our parlance in Great Manager, you know, we talk about the difference between a manager and a boss. And this gets into that same mentality of being a boss is being about holding on to something and top down, et cetera, versus being a great manager or a leader. I tend to use the terms interchangeably, but I think his underlying point of defense of the status quo versus the willingness to lead change is apropos. And whether we call that leadership or management, you know, you can break it down even to the task level, right? There are times when we are managing and we do work in a company and we do have a certain amount of structure and organization. And there are moments when management is needed, but there are moments when leadership is needed. And it's certainly a higher order of thinking. So I may not take as strong a bent against management as Seth does. He has a particular axe to grind, and that's what this book is designed to do. But I agree with him wholeheartedly that if you're defending the status quo, you are at odds with the nature of a tribe, which wants to move forward and wants to embrace change. And as managers, if that's all we do, if all we're ever there for is to enforce the rules, keep things by the book, or defend what is, then ultimately we're headed towards obsolescence, because I don't need people to enforce rules all day long. I need people who can lead change, who can communicate, who can move the needle and move the team forward. So I do think he's right. We need leaders. And I think we need leaders more often than we need managers. But I think a lot of those folks are probably one and the same. And there's moments for each. But I think he's right. I think leaders are the future, and for a lot of reasons.
It did make me think, specifically with this topic, with the informal leaders coming up and the difference he spoke about with managers and leaders, it made me think to how it used to be, oh, it's the beer business, this is how it's always been. Well, in my almost 19 years, there has been an evolution of, you know, new ideas, new ways of doing things. So it makes me think of some managers of the past who perhaps didn't make it because, you know, they weren't willing to change with the new thoughts.
No, I agree with Suzanne. I think it comes down to there's a balance, right? There's a balance between what he defines is sort of change agent type leadership, kind of break the mold and go, and, you know, day-to-day great management. But at the end of the day, if everyone functioned and followed this book as a guide, it would result in absolute chaos.
The first book club that we did was Dave Ramsey's book, Entree Leader. And what I love about that book, really more than anything, is the title, right? Because Ramsey's whole thesis there, and if you haven't listened to that, you should go back and check out season one of the Brew You Book Club. But Ramsey's whole thesis there is he wants entree leaders, people who can sometimes be entrepreneurs and sometimes be leaders, because his organization demands both. And I think that's the goal for us, to me, to my mind, has always been to develop those entree leaders who can who know when to manage and know when to lead. Like I said, Godin has a particular axe to grind here. He's trying to inspire leadership on a grand scale. He's not wrong, but we function day to day, and I think there's a place for both for us. And I think that actually leads me to the next thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about and get your thoughts on, which is his topic about what he calls leading from the bottom. You know, we talk a lot in J.J. Taylor about leading from the front and that we expect leaders who are engaged and out front and working along with their people. And that's great. But I also really loved his concept of leading from the bottom, and that oftentimes, especially in this more tribal mentality, that it's not going to be somebody whose title makes them a leader. There are going to be informal leaders, leaders who set themselves apart by building their own tribe. And I'm wondering if that's something that resonated with anybody else, or if you've got any great examples that sort of popped to mind when you thought about this.
Yeah, there's a very specific scenario that popped into my mind when I was reading that portion. So when I first transitioned to the nighttime warehouse, and, you know, just observing the culture and what was going on around there, there was a certain order selector that you could tell that people tend to gravitate to. And he wasn't necessarily doing what he should be doing, so people would follow. So this was a conversation that I had with him. I pulled him to the side and I said, hey, you know, people tend to follow you. So it's like, if you don't like what's going on around here, I'm going to need you to step up and start doing what you're supposed to do. And then you can lead by example. Because if people think that it's okay for you to do things and you're a natural leader, then it's going to be a lot harder and to get the culture around here to change just with me alone. I need other people to help me do this. And he did, and he's still here.
Nate, what a great example, right? Because this is exactly what Godin's talking about, is that tribes are going to form. They're going to take place. Someone who is a part of the community is going to step up and become a leader. And what's interesting about leading from the bottom in the context of us as, you know, managers, those who are anointed with positions of authority within the company, is we have to embrace that and to the right extent and in the right way encourage that kind of behavior, because it's going to happen. And what you described there, Nate, is exactly it. Is you can't stop somebody from building that tribe. If you fight that tribe, you can find yourself at odds with your team pretty quick. If you embrace that tribe and become a part of that tribe, you can steer it in the direction that benefits everybody. And so oftentimes, I think insecure leaders, leaders who feel like their authority comes from power, comes from a mandate, they see tribes starting to form, starting to coalesce within their teams, and they worry about it. And they think, oh, this person's going to upstage me. They're coming for my job. They're taking the team in the wrong direction, and they want to squash it. But in reality, you're never going to stop those tribes from occurring if you can instead embrace those tribes, embrace that behavior, and steer it into a productive direction. You leverage its power as opposed to fighting its momentum. And I think that's hugely important for leaders to understand, that tribes are out there. Your team is going to become a part of certain tribes. If you try to stifle that behavior, you're setting yourself up for a hard fight. If you embrace it, you might be able to use it to your advantage.
I think it's a good topic to bring up too. We've had recent conversations just with recruiting and, you know, the new crop generation, whatever we want to call them, coming into the workforce. And this is a group who feels empowered, maybe not having the most experience, but they definitely feel empowered. So how are we going to harness that as leaders of the company? We're the ones that are going to have to change to harness that. You know, we can't expect them to fall in line, air quote. So it's definitely a topic that, as he was describing it in the book, it made me think of this new gen coming up into the workforce.
I agree, Suzanne, and you and I have had sort of a sidebar about this once or twice before, and this is not a J.J. Taylor thing. This is just a cultural workplace paradigm shift, where the expectations of younger generations are different than current and older generations. And there's two ways to go about it. One is we fight against what those expectations are, and we tell them this is the way it's going to be. And if we do that, we are sure to fail. And the other way is we try to understand where those expectations come from. And we try to do our best to build a workplace, a work environment, job roles, structures, all those sorts of things that meet the expectations of those younger generations as best we can. And it's all about finding the things that motivate individuals or groups of people and doing your best to provide those sorts of motivating factors.
That almost makes me think of another part of the book called Writing Songs That Spread, where Seth talks about tribes exist and they have understandings amongst themselves and they communicate, and it's our job to figure out what's important to them and how they communicate.
Yeah, I loved that section of the book. And it's a small section, but it's a section of the book called Writing Songs That Spread is really profound. In it, Seth recounts a story of a charitable group that was looking to get their message out in Rwandan communities. And they put together these posters that were really great. And they put them all up over Rwanda. And they missed the mark because 70% of the population was illiterate. And it didn't matter how well written the posters were, they couldn't read them. And what it took was a volunteer on the ground who understood the culture, who understood the tribe, to say they communicate in song. They sing songs to each other. It's a gift. It's a way to remember things. It's a communication style. If we can write a song that fits their culture, that might be the way to get our message out. And it turned out that it was. And what Seth says about it that I think is so fascinating as a thought, and it certainly was one that provoked me quite a bit, was you do have to meet the tribe, especially an existing tribe, tribes that are forming on their own. They have their own style of communication. They have their own way of communicating. You have to meet them there. You can't just swoop in and say, now this is how we do it. If you really want to steer the tribe, you must become a part of the tribe in order to lead the tribe. And in order to become a part of the tribe, you have to embrace what already is there, its culture, its terms, et cetera. And I think there's a lot of ways that that can apply. So I'll throw it here back to the group and say, what are some thoughts around communication, communicating with tribes, existing tribes? As leaders, what do we have to take away from this in terms of what do we do to make sure that we can speak to tribes as they are?
I think probably my team is a pretty younger generation team. So example of what I did. So I have different ways of communicating than what they were. Like that was a big difference for me. But if I want them to do, like the way that I see it is, if you want somebody to do something, or you need to understand a little bit of where they're coming from. So it's like a give and take. So it's like, I spend time understanding different types of lingo that they talk and, you know, different things that they're interested in. And then so I can relate to them, and then I get more back in return because I put the time in for them. Now, when I ask them to do something, I get the same respect back. So I think that's kind of like the communication factor. It's like, when you have a disconnect or you're coming into a different tribe, you need to do your own research and figure that out if you want something in return.
You got to learn their vibe. Straight facts, no cap. Otherwise, they get the ick.
Facts.
Allie's cringing, by the way.
Painful.
Allie's teaching Jeff new words.
No, it's worse. It's the other way around. I learn these things and then I'll say them to her and she just falls over cringe.
Ugh,
right?
Because her can't take it.
I give her the ick on a weekly basis when I bring in my new Jed Zealand.
That's because you got that riz, Jeff.
Straight fire, Nate.
No cap.
But it's so true, right? If you have to meet them on their terms. You have to show that ingratiating and be willing to understand. And yeah, I think whether it's an age generational thing or a line of the business thing or whatever it is that makes that tribe tick, you've got to be willing to meet them on their terms.
Jeff, can I pose a question to this group?
Please do.
And also invite anyone who listens to this podcast to respond directly if you have thoughts about this. But I took the communication question from this book sort of three ways. One is you have to have a very clear vision at the top of a tribe or a company or an organization, which is clearly articulated to the members of that tribe or the employees of an organization so that they understand where the company is headed, what it's all about, why we do the things that we do, why we do the way that we do them. I think J.J. Taylor has done a pretty phenomenal job of really simplifying that message. What do? We sell beer. And why do we do it? Because we have a very clear set of values and we're going to live by those values. That part can probably always be improved upon, but I think it's largely there. My question there would be, are we, as an organization, out telling people the underlying strategy behind that vision as often or as clearly as we should be, if we think we need to do it? The other two angles are equally, if not more important. The flip side of that is bottoms up. Do we do enough to hear from employees? This goes back to the conversation that Suzanne raised about understanding what motivates younger generations, what their expectations are, what they're seeking out. Do we do a good enough job asking the right questions and listening to the answers we get from employees about those types of motivating factors? And then the third is, do we provide the right tools, the right forums, the right opportunities for employees across different groups, across different tribes, or within a tribe to communicate with one another, sharing ideas, building relationships, all sorts of things that I think, as he describes it, makes your tribe tighter, not just bigger.
I think that we have a lot of tools and opportunities for almost any level of employee to communicate all the way to the top. I mean, we use the podcast here as an example. I mean, Zach's in here, obviously, so can't get much higher than that. And I mean, if we use like Kazoo and things, we have other opportunities that we're out in front of the curve, you would say. We're ahead of the curve on a lot of things with the communication front. We do peer panel feedbacks and, you know, just different types of groups. So I at least for my teams, I feel like if we were to talk to most of the employees, they would feel that their voice is heard or they have an understanding of why things are going on and why we do things that we do.
Yeah, my take is certainly we could always be better. I think the tools we use the most are engaged managers. So certainly there's pockets, departments that are more engaged than others with their frontline employees. You know, those teams we probably see more success, more less turnover, things like that. But I think we could always be better. And we do have so many segments, populations, groups, some who come to the building every day, many who are remote, who we don't see every day. So really, we do count on those managers as being our engagement.
After, well, coming out of spring training, which thanks to everybody that participated, it was so fun. We loved it. It from the side of administering it, it made us realize that we're lacking in communication channels and certain ways to reach certain employees, and some of the feedback that we got was certain employees wanted to talk to each other and couldn't, I think we're doing a pretty good job, but it made us realize that we can always do better and make it easier. We want to make it easy for anybody to talk to anybody else, and we realize that there were some serious hiccups in running a program like that.
You know, do I think we do a good job of communicating our vision, our mission, our core values? Absolutely, I do. You know, we're never going to stop. That is a evergreen pasture. But I think we do a pretty good job of explaining ourselves and our why and what we do and why we do it. I think sometimes we could probably do more to explain our tactics. I think because we run at 1,000 miles an hour, slowing down to remember to explain the details can sometimes be a challenge for some teams. Others are very good at it. It really does depend on, you know, the leader of a particular tribe. I think, Zach, the thing that you posed that certainly had piqued my interest coming off this book is the communication amongst the members of the tribe. Godin describes it two ways. He says the leader has to be able to speak to the tribe. The tribe has to be able to speak to the leader. I think we're pretty good on those two fronts. Certainly always room for improvement. The one that I'm most curious about, and again, I would invite anybody who's listening, send me an email, send any one of us an email, post up on our Instagram or wherever you're hearing this and let us know your thoughts as well. Or next time you see me in the hallway, grab me and tell me what your thoughts on this. I think there's an opportunity coming off of this to really look at how good are we at helping foster connection amongst the members of the tribe, not just top down up to top. Because, like you said, Nate, I think we're pretty good at our managers telling our employees things. I think our employees feel pretty good about being able to come to us, but could we do more to make it easier for small tribes to embrace each other and get tighter because they can communicate on a more regular basis? I still think there's an opportunity there that could help really advance that idea. So I'm going to be exploring that. Allie and I have got some discussions to be had coming off this book, I think, about what we can do to foster those little communities that exist, those little tribes that are out there, and help amplify them because they exist. They're part of our world. We can't fight them. We need to instead lean in and amplify and raise them up. How do we get those little groups of sales assistants, sales reps, drivers together and let them become a tight little tribe and make sure that they've got a way that works to communicate and tighten it and, leverage themselves into bigger and better things? I think that's a good question and a challenge that certainly came to me coming off this book that I think can do more.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because those mini tribes communicate totally differently. So,
well, and Allie, you've seen some of that. I know coming off your ride widths, and I know this was 2 years ago, but coming off your ride widths in Treasure Coast, I remember you talking a lot about the delivery guys having a big group text chain down there, right?
Yeah, it on multiple ride widths. They have big group chats. That was their team's main mode of communication, and it was so different than how. So, like the time that I spend the Fort Myers warehouse operated or with drivers in Tampa. It was just, it's interesting to see how they communicate and how they, or the tools that they use and how they speak to each other, yeah.
There was one scenario that I had. It's a little, well, we're talking about trying to get other groups to conform to what your group is doing. And I kind of related that to like rehires in general, because like people that leave our tribe because they're looking for something better, but then they realize that it's not, they might not have the right mentality that we're looking for, and bringing those people back into the group is an easy way out. And I thought that that was related. I'd rather find somebody new that can see the vision from the beginning, and then we can spend our time and efforts on them, than bringing someone that has basically already quit on us once before. What's going to stop them from doing it a second time? It'll be a lot easier the second time around than it was the first time.
I think that's a great point, Nate, because, Godin does talk about how with tribes, the coalescing factor is the belief in the idea, in the movement. And when somebody takes off from the tribe, they're essentially admitting that I don't believe so much in the movement. I'm here for something else. My priorities are bigger than this one thing. Now, certain, it's now we're into where life gets in the way of theory, right? There, certain pieces aside, moving for family, moving for extenuating circumstances. If people are leaving us because they don't believe in first choice, they don't believe in the mission, they don't believe in what we're out to set to do, I think you're right. I think there's something to be said for if they come back, you got to question the motivation a little bit, because the motivation has to be about the mission in order to be part of the tribe. And are we interviewing that way? Are we hiring and selecting that way? Are we picking people who want to be part of the tribe, not just want to get the paycheck? And if we're not, we're probably setting ourselves up for guys who will, as you point out, jump to the next paycheck any old time. So I think it's a great question that we probably should think more about in our selection process is, are we hiring people because they fit the tribe or because they fill the job? It better be the former, because the latter is just going to churn and burn all day long.
That also ties into the other season of The Ideal Team Player.
That's right. If you want to figure out how to select the ones that are best for your tribe, check out season 2 of the Blue Ribbon Book Club, The Ideal Team Player.
For the record, that's the third plug between Jeff and Allie today.
I'm impressed.
Nothing but shameless self-promotion around here. That's right.
Jeff, I would love to talk about heretics and rabble-rousers, because I love the term rabble-rouser, and I thought the concept was interesting.
Well, it's fun to say.
It is very fun to say, and maybe it's a question for the group. You know, heretic is a strong word with typically a pretty negative connotation, but used in a very different way by Seth in this book. And I guess the question is, are there individuals, if we use heretic in a positive way, within J.J. Taylor that we would call a rabble-rouser or a heretic, people that are inspiring change by openly challenging the status quo?
I'm going to hide off camera for a second. Pretty sure I've been called a rabble-rouser at least once or twice. Yeah, I can think of several, but I'll throw it out to the group first and say, guys, you want to, we don't have to call out names, but anybody got any examples that they can at least come to mind with?
I mean, there's different levels of that. So you might think that it could be negative and you don't want to tie yourself into that, but I'd like to think of myself as one of those. I've been known in the past to be a little bit more extreme, but I learned how to dial that down a little bit, right, Susie? I think it's a good thing. Like, there's nothing wrong with asking questions, and like he says in the book, if you never ask the question, how are you going to know what the answer is? You might not hear the right answer, or you might not hear the answer that you would like to hear, but at least you have an answer. And, you know, that's the difference between, I guess, the not yet or no or yes, and at least in my opinion.
Yeah, the word heretic struck me as well, as because I read the book and then I went back and listened to the audio. And every time he said it, it sort of made me itchy, because that is such a strong word. So I actually went and looked up the definition, because I was like, am I thinking of the wrong word? Finally, about 5 down, the definition was opposite of popular opinion. But, you know, the first 3 or 4 definitions were very strong in negative in connotation. So when you think about it as just, yeah, challenging status quo and opposite of popular opinion, I think it settles a little bit better. And I do think we have some, and I think the good leaders do come in with new ideas. And it also leads me to managers with their team not being afraid to hear their team members asking those questions of why, or challenging why we're doing things, perhaps to find a new way to do it. And it made me think of our current managers a lot, that in my head I'm thinking, gosh, I hope they're encouraging their team members to come and ask why, to understand if for nothing else, or to suggest new ways of doing things.
Yeah, I consider myself one, and I consider it an unwritten part of my job description. For better or for worse, this is something that I've always, in everywhere that I've ever worked, prided myself on, is I want to be known as someone who makes some noise and who challenges some assumptions and is going to get some stuff wrong. And, you know, there's a significant long list of swings and misses in the Brew University pantheon, but there's a lot of hits too. And those hits came because we swung at the ball. And I encourage that with both of my team members now, is to say, you know, you can't do something audacious without trying to do something audacious. So you got to be willing to take a swing, and if it hits, it hits. If it misses, it misses. And then you get back up at bat and go again. But, you know, maybe it's because I've been reading Godin for 20 years and his stuff is melted into the deepest parts of my brain. Or maybe it's just because I, you know, was the kid that couldn't sit still in class and had to ask teachers questions that they didn't always appreciate. But it is, I think, part of what I like doing is rabble rousing and being a bit of a heretic and you know, making burgers out of sacred cows, as I will sometimes refer to it. But it's, if you don't, one of the things that Godin says that I think is so fascinating is that idea that managers are fighting risk, and risk is essentially change. And every manager I've ever talked to, every leader I've ever talked to, every class on leadership I have ever taught or been a part of, I've never known a manager or a leader anywhere who wouldn't tell you that change is inevitable. Change is the only constant. Change is the thing that's always going to happen. And yet how many of them fight change, resist change, or hesitant to change? And it's like, if you know it's inevitable, if you know change is coming, why manage against it when you could lean into it? And so I guess for me, it's always been being a heretic, as it were, is just trying to be on the leading edge of change as opposed to the reactive end, to have a hand on the wheel and be able to steer that change that is inevitable into a direction that I feel strongly about, for whatever reason. So I think it's a strong word. I think it's meant to be provocative. I think Godin is trying to make a point about how hard this can be and how much of an outsider you can feel like to take strong positions like that. But I think without strong positions, we don't find the edges, and finding the edges is important to finding the path. You got to define the outside to know where the inside is. So I love it, but I'm the weirdo like that.
No, well said.
Zach, do you consider yourself a heretic?
Using your definition of heretic, which I like much better than someone who practices heresy, then yes, I like to think so. And I would have put Nate and Jeff both in that rabble-rouser bucket and greatly appreciate them for it. So I guess a corollary to that is, do we encourage the rabble-rousers to, as Nate said, to ask the questions that maybe others are uncomfortable to ask, or to pose new ways of doing things which maybe challenge the status quo? Do we do enough to encourage those individuals to feel comfortable as opposed to, you know, feeling a sense of fear by trying to change the way we've done things historically?
I like to think, on at least in my team, I encourage them to speak up and give their opinion. It's like we have some sort of communication with all the order selectors every single day. I have a little huddle, talk. Is there anything that we can do to help you? Do you have anything that, you know, we need to change? Or, you know, just little things like that to provide an opportunity. That I feel that has really helped with the team in general, because they're, as you do it more consistently, maybe people who aren't as comfortable speaking up in that type of environment, they've seen a few people do it, so they get more comfortable, and then it creates a more open environment, and we've got a lot accomplished, and like everybody has more invested into the whole process, because now they have something that they feel they've added to the cause.
Because of the process that you've gone through, Nate, and the approach that you've taken with that organization over the past 2 years, you have rightfully earned the trust of all of those individuals. And if they trust you, they are going to be far more willing to come forward and have those open conversations and make those sorts of suggestions or ask those sorts of questions. And obviously something that we teach heavily as part of formerly Great Manager Program, now Ambassador Bootcamp, is how critical that trust is to successful organizations.
So there's a section of the book where he says that not yet is worse than no. And man, what a profound statement. This is so simple, but I love it. That not yet, when the answer to the question, can we do this, should we do this, is not yet, it leaves us with this audacity of hope. It paralyzes our other alternatives, because if that's our preferred choice, we think, well, it might have its day. And, you know, when we talk about five dysfunctions, we talk about the importance of decisions being final and binding. Not yet is the antithesis of final and binding. It's a way to stifle innovation without making somebody feel bad. No almost becomes the better answer, because no gives us the freedom to unhook and move on and go somewhere else. But when we get not yet, we're holding on to this little thread of maybe. It's the classic, you ask your parents, can we do something? Maybe. Maybe was always worse than no. At least no, you moved on with your day. But when it's maybe, when it's not yet, it puts us in a limbo that causes us to fall behind. And I wondered what you guys thought about that particular section of not yet versus no.
Yeah, the quote that I highlighted on that was, change almost never fails because it's too early. It almost always fails because it's too late.
Absolutely. What a simple but profound statement to say. Is it time to do this? Not yet. Well, more likely than not yet becomes too late instead of yes.
I will admit that I am bad at this. I don't like closing doors. I like to keep opportunities open, but this has given me a very different way of looking at this. I am probably more likely to say not yet or something like not yet. Let's pause and think about that again in 90 days, whatever it might be, as opposed to no, which then allows people to clear that off their plate entirely, go focus on other things. I think the way he puts it is it puts off the inevitable. It's kicking the can down the road, and you're going to get there most likely anyhow, so just rip the Band-Aid off and do it now. This is a key takeaway for me from this book. It does not mean that I will not say not yet once in a while, or let's put that on the back burner and come back to it, but I will think a bit more about it before I say it.
It's also, it's kind of a conflict avoider. And instead of just getting to the point, you're putting it off for later because you don't want to deal with what is, you know, in front of you at that moment. So there's different perspectives. I was thinking of a scenario like feedback when I did interviews for different positions and the no's, because depending on how you give that feedback, it can relate to like the not yet scenario. You go, oh, you were doing everything just great. It just wasn't your time. I think that's a generic statement because you went with somebody else for a reason. So just rip the Band-Aid off and tell them the truth so they can either get better and move forward, or they'll just continue to stay in the same scenario and you know you've made the right decision at the moment.
Oh, Nate, what a great example. Yeah, lack of conflict. It's level two dysfunction, right? And we know that, but yet we engage in it. What a great way to contextualize that. What's next?
There's a section I think follows this not yet is worse than no section about listening, and I think he makes a reference to Ronald Reagan as a fantastic active listener. And the key takeaway for me is yes. Active listening is an important skill for us as leaders to continue to work on. People want to be heard. They want to people want to know that you are listening to them, that you are paying attention to them, that you are hearing what they are saying. The interesting thing I thought was, that does not mean that you need to do what that individual asks or suggests just because you listened to them. Listening, hearing, understanding, and then stepping back and saying, I heard you, but we're going to do something else anyhow, is as acceptable as doing what that individual would have liked you to do.
Yeah, that I really liked that section about Ronald Reagan too, and the listening piece. Because he also talks about leaders don't have to be charismatic. You don't have to be this character that he kind of describes people thinking, oh, I'll fail. I'm not a leader. Oh, you know, I'm not this great speaker. I'm not a leader. But just sort of sitting back and listening as a huge piece for a leader. But of course, then validating what the team member is saying.
Well, and Suzanne, that I couldn't agree more. And I think that is what really struck me as he sort of winds down to the end of the book, is he talks about there is no mold for leadership. Leaders don't look like anything or anyone. Leadership's a choice, and anyone can make that choice. If we want to be leaders, then we lead. We embrace the role, we lead our tribe, and we go forward. We communicate, we foster communication, we sense that shared purpose, and we go to it. That anything less than that is just management, but that at the end of the day, the only definition of a leader is someone who leads. There's no checklist. There's no, you know, these are the things you do. And I think frustratingly, he really does not give us that map. But, you know, famously, Seth, one of my favorite quotes of his, and it's not from this book, it's another one, but says there is no map to great leadership. There can't be. And I think that's such a great point, is there is no definition of a leader other than someone who can lead. If you do it, you're a leader. If you're not doing it, you're not a leader, but anyone can be. And I think that's a big part of what he tries to rail home at the end in inspiring his audience to take up and lead their tribe, is that anyone's capable of this, but the only difference between leaders and non-leaders are those who lead.
I was going to say, add to that, Jeff, the one, there was a quote in there where you're talking about getting to different levels of leadership and where you're the most comfortable, but people get to the point to where they fail, or they just get to the point or where they're scared to fail. So it's pushing yourself past the uncomfortable situations and being more comfortable in them is how you continue to grow and get better. Like, if you're not comfortable with being uncomfortable, then you're just going to be stuck in your current situation forever.
I think being, well, a little more settled now, I'm in my second year here, but at first I was coming into this workspace trying to do everything right. And I think my biggest takeaway from this, which would have been nice a year ago, was the secret to being wrong isn't to avoid being wrong. It's being willing to be wrong, knowing that wrong isn't fatal. And that ties into his other quote, that being a leader is you're doing what hasn't been done before. You're not doing what's been done, then you'd just be managing, you're not leading.
Jeff, I think I am glad that you suggested this book. I think I learned a couple of things from it, and a couple of things from this conversation, which I will certainly take away and try to improve, you know, my leadership style because of. But we have, you know, we have a fantastic culture honed over decades at J.J. Taylor, which, you know, we're fortunate that we have a leadership team that truly buys into and tries to live those values every day. And I think Nate is the perfect example of that in practice, and of this book in practice. And I am grateful to be part of an organization with people like Nate in it doing this every day, because I don't think that this is really all that common. If you look at our competitors or other companies of similar sizes. So really enjoyed this, and thank you for putting it together. This book will go behind me next to my desk and will become a reference guide going forward.
Excellent. That's what we're hoping to do with the book club, is get you guys stuff that can move the needle and inspire and encourage us to go in new directions and to be that nice little booster shot of motivation that we all need from time to time. I'll ask the rest of the bookies as well. Good book. Would you recommend it? Was it a good summer read? Give me your final thoughts on this.
Yes, I actually gave my copy to one of the guys last night who was asking questions about the book. And he is he's interested in becoming a leader. So I gave him the example, because this will give you what you need, because they asked me, I want to be in the position to be a leader. And just read this book and you'll understand you already are in that position.
Yep, I agree. This was a good summer, easy read. And I've also had a couple people who've seen the book on my desk. So we've got a waiting list for the books.
I thought this was a great book. I have a very different view of what is an enjoyable beach read than you guys do.
Allie, final thoughts?
I loved it. Easy to digest, and it's got a lot of big ideas, but I think it could be very practical for anybody that's interested in being a leader. I think if everybody grabbed this book and everybody was like, let's create change right now, it would be a little hectic, but if you're interested in leadership, I think this is a great reference guide to go back to.
Awesome. Well, the book is Tribes by Seth Godin. You can get it anywhere that you get your books. It's also available in audio format. So if you like listening to us talk about it, you might like listening to the actual book being read to you by the author. So check that out. Wherever you get your books from, you can find it. Tribes by Seth Godin. This has been a absolute joy. I love doing book club podcast, and I love having you guys with me. So let me take a moment here and thank each and every one of my bookies again for being a part of this. Allie, thank you for joining us on this adventure and being a part of the Brew You Book Club.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Zach, thank you for joining us and taking time out of your summer vacation to be here and talk about Tribes.
No, this was awesome.
Nate the Great, thank you for waking up early and joining us for this one. I appreciate it.
Who said I ever went to bed?
And Suzanne, I couldn't do a book club without you. So thank you as always for motivating me to get these done and being a part of it.
Thank you for including me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And it's been great to be back. Thank you all for listening. We couldn't do this, of course, without our little tribe of podcast listeners. And we appreciate every one of you. Tell your friends, share the story, get this out there for folks. We hope you guys are enjoying it. We've got a couple more books in our summer series, so check those out as well. They'll be coming to you here along the feed. So make sure you're subscribed in order to get all the great stuff that we're putting out on the Brew You Book Club this summer. The summer reading spectacular continues on, and I thank you guys all for being a part of it. I'm Jeff Weaver, your host, and have a great rest of your day. Get out there and do a little reading. Enjoy it.